Remains True presents Spiritual Power, Spiritual Practice with medical intuitive and the author of Anatomy of the Spirit, Dr. Carolyn Mace. For over a decade, Carolyn Mace has taught the science of energy anatomy, how the energy centers, known as chakras, are connected with physical health and spiritual well-being. Now, for the first time, Carolyn Mace teaches the daily disciplines required to put her teachings into everyday practice. We begin with a discussion of the principles underlying daily practice. And then on tape two, there are two guided meditations, one for the morning and one for the evening. And now, Spiritual Power, Spiritual Practice with Dr. Carolyn Mace.
In my work with energy anatomy, I give a detailed description of the human energy system, explaining the seven energy centers or chakras of the human body. These are spiritual power centers associated with the physical body. Each one represents a different quality of power, and understanding these powers is a means through which your spiritual power develops into consciousness. Spiritual powers, as I define them, are energies such as integrity, endurance, harmony, love, forgiveness, wisdom, judgment, and the capacity to let go of personal will and allow divine will to enter and influence your life as the only influence in your life. I speak a great deal in this program on discipline and practice because we cannot move into the area of true spiritual power without understanding that we need an internal discipline in order to develop these qualities. Discipline means that we sit each day with ourselves, that we review ourselves. We review our behavior, our choices. We review what goodness we've contributed to the earth and to the lives of other people, and what negativity we've contributed. And we pull back that negativity and replace it with the lesson we learned by moving into the temporary misuse of our own power, of our own spirit. This type of review and practice allows us to grow every day in this dynamic called consciousness, because that is what we say we are here to do, develop our consciousness. This meditation series is my contribution to that path. And it's my hope that it works beautifully for each person listening. The most important ingredient we can understand about the human experience is power. For me, power is the central ingredient of the human experience because power is fundamentally our soul. It is this part of ourselves that we incarnate to learn how to manage on this planet. The role of our spirit is to learn wise investments. The image I ask people to work with is that of thinking of themselves as bankers, and that you receive $100 worth of investment capital per day. And with this $100, you learn how to make investments that are wise because you want to live off your interest. If you make investments that aren't wise, you're going to go into debt. And if you go into debt, you need to take out loans. The first place you'll go for a loan is into your creativity. You'll drain the energy you have for today's life. You'll drain that. The next thing you know, you'll drain the energy of your social life, of your friendships, of your relationships, because you won't have energy for that. The next place you'll go is you'll drain your cell tissue. You'll pull the energy out of your cell tissue. And finally, this precious essence called power, your spirit, will have been released into energetic investments that lack wisdom and that lack any means to bring that support and energy to your body. We need to know how to follow our spirit, to see what we've invested it in, to feel that spirit, to feel what attitude it's in, to feel what relationship it's invested in. We need to feel that. We need to be able to close our eyes and feel what parts of our body those investments are nurturing or draining. We need a daily spiritual practice. What is a practice? A practice is a discipline, a means of developing a strong will, and ironically, it's a will strong enough to release your will. The most powerful act of will is to have no will. It's a paradox, but the divine speaks in paradox. The language of heaven is the language of paradox. What you think is large is really small. What you think is small is really large. When something is visible, the power is really invisible. When you see no power, it's full of power. This is the language of the divine. The role of every spiritual path and the role of your practice is not to understand mystery, but to give up the need to understand mystery. The role of your path is not to settle and solve why things happen as they do, but to give up the need to know why things happen as they do. It's this release of power that we are always working toward. This is our goal. This is the focus of human discipline. The support of that discipline needs to be prayer, needs to be practice. Practice. What do we practice? We practice looking at what we cannot do and learning how to do that. We practice at looking at what we know is truth and how we are not in harmony with that truth. We practice at looking, where am I losing power and why, when I know better than to lose power in this way. We look at ourselves in the smallest way. How come when I can be in such a small circumstance as someone in line ahead of me, that I lose my power? Is this all it takes for me to lose my power, while 5 minutes later I refer to myself as conscious? Is this all it takes? For me, it's all it takes. But, I mean, is this all it takes? I mean, we have to ask ourselves, are we really that capable of centering? The spiritual practice is something I tell people, and I will ask them, when you do your meditation, do you need to have a room that's quiet? Do you need to have a beautiful view? Do you need to have beautiful music? Do you? Does that work for you? Most people would say yes. To which I respond, then the room's doing the meditating for you. The role is, if you really want to learn the discipline, put yourself into a circumstance that's very uncomfortable. Very, very uncomfortable. Play the sort of music you cannot tolerate. Put on the light you don't want to look at. And then command your spirit. See how much power you have. Then command your spirit to not be aware of that, to not be ruffled by that. This is power. This is power, to be able to command your spirit. When you are in a situation and you feel your spirit going to somebody or something and giving them your power, can you call it back? Can you say to your spirit, get over here. What are you doing? Get back inside of me. What are you doing? Come back here. Are you strong enough to do that? That's the question. That's the role of a practice. This is what spiritual discipline is all about. The capacity to hold tight to your spirit above physical circumstances. This is transcendence. This is what it means. The journey of practice takes us into parts of ourselves. There are addicts, where we're addicted, where we have to have things or people or situations because we think that is our power. We have to figure out, we have to identify, what are these things that we are so attached to that we think give us power? What does that feel like? Why do we need that? We have to identify the core question I'm going to ask you to think about. What is power for you? Now note, the first part of yourself that's going to answer that question is your mind. You're going to note a mental response and ask yourself that. What's power? In that mental response, I want you to scratch it because it doesn't mean anything. Now ask it again from that part of yourself that knows better. Go into your shadow. Go into that part of yourself you would not admit in public. Go into that part of yourself that lives behind closed doors and would say something like, power is my capacity to control. To control what? Ask yourself, what do you want to control? Others. Ask yourself, why do you want to control that? What kind of power is it within that scheme that brings you peace? Now, if you were to sit with that idea that I need power to control the outside world, then what does that tell you about the power you think you need on your inside world? You need to think about these two points within yourself because they're different. They're opposite. They're juxtaposed. This is not the power we're seeking spiritually. It's, in fact, the ability to go into any world, any situation, any relationship, and not lose your power over that relationship. To be able to stand still, and no matter what type of energy is coming toward you, that you don't lose yourself, that you don't find yourself frightened, that you don't find yourself enraged, that you don't find yourself competitive, that you don't find yourself jealous of another person's role in your life, but rather that you can hold the center and say that you are here because you have a contract. You have a sacred contract that represents your role in this life. And your role in this life is fundamentally the management of that spirit, your energy, no matter what circumstance you go in. And that at the end of the day, the greatest act we can do is to go to bed each evening more and more prepared to say, thy will be done, and to release that will. In the essence of mysticism, that's where tranquility comes from. When those who have the greatest will have no will. Think of the nature of divine mystery. Think for one moment what makes it divine is that there's no human reason in it. That's what makes it divine reason. You can't see human reason in it. Always within divine will, there's that essence of, I don't understand how that could happen to that person. I don't understand why God would ask this of me. I have no talent in that area. I don't understand why God would ask me to do this. I have no strength. I have no power. By saying yes, by saying, here, take my will. I cannot possibly make the decisions necessary for this part of my life. Then those decisions are made for you. And power, in its true form, that which is divine, flows into your life and begins to maneuver and to take charge in a way that your own personality can't do. So what are the areas that you want to look at? What do you want to think about when you think, what do I examine in myself? What questions in my life do I need to think about that help me identify power, that help me identify my practice, that help me identify my journey? One of the questions that you need to ask yourself the most is, what are you attached to? What attachments draw your power out of you? You need to know this. You need to be able to sense within yourself, very honestly, what you're attached to. One of the ways that helps you out to really recognize that you have an attachment to something that's causing your power to leave you is to ask yourself, would I be embarrassed to admit this? Embarrassment is a great teacher. Shame is a great teacher. Would this be uncomfortable for you to admit to somebody? And then you know you're sitting on some level of truth within yourself. In reviewing all of the challenges in your life, you can do it through the lens of power struggle, just through the lens of what you're learning about power. That's the only question you can enter into it with. When you look at this and you think, what am I learning about power? Then that will take you into every other challenge in your life. For example, I'm asked frequently, how do I detach from something? How do I do that? How do I cut the cords with somebody? So let's talk about something like cutting cords. What does that mean? To separate yourself from those sources that are draining your energy. For example, your history, your childhood. One of the most frequent sources of energy drain that I have observed with people is that they continue to lose their energy to their childhood, to that which happened yesterday. The reasons they frequently offer as to why they simply can't, quote, cut the cord is for this reason or that, because they haven't had a chance to understand why that happened. If they could only understand why this happened to them, why they should have had the right mother, they should have had a different father. The pursuit of the question why is the most suffering question you can ask. You'll never get the answer. You will never get the answer. So long as you need the answer, you'll never get the answer. When you get to the point where you don't need the answer, you'll get the answer. This is the essence of practice. To get to that point when you don't need the answer, you'll get the answer. How do we reach that? One of the techniques you want to work into practice is to be able to take your deep breath and recognize, I am very attached to that memory. The second thing you want to do is to recognize how attached you are and to follow that into the behavior it triggers in your life today. You can see this. This is not that difficult. But the third thing you want to look at is how much extra power do you give that in a way to block off the power of truth that could be sitting in its place. I want to give you an example of that. When people hold on to a memory, such as, I would be a much more successful person today if this event had not happened to me yesterday, rather than to say, I'm going to release that memory and take up what my life would look like without the burden of having to finance a memory with the precious energy I have today. When you can begin to look at your life that way and step out of it for a minute, you can see it as a mechanical drama that you're playing pieces with. What piece from your past that you simply need to release? In cutting a cord, what you know deep in your heart, deep in your gut, deep in that part of the package that you were born knowing is, nothing in your life will be the same again. Consider this picture. Who you are today and who you will be every single day of your life is based solely on the ingredients of what you believe, what you hold spiritually as truth, all of your emotions, all of your attitudes, and the history you hold on to. Additionally, there's always what you want to think of as God's seat at your round table. And you don't know all of the force and the light and the karma that sits there. So we leave that seat there with great honor, but we can see the others that we're in charge of. Now, those other voices, which live in our interior, hold a place in our lives, even down to this level. They've arranged the furniture in our house. They've chosen the block we live on. They've decided who our friends are. They've decided what kind of music we like and what kind of food we eat. And I mean this down to the most minute detail. They've chosen the seasonings in our cupboards. They've chosen everything. They've chosen your friends. They've chosen the movies you like. Inherent, before we were born, we are given certain tablets of knowledge. Let's put it that way. Every one of us is born with what's called the natural law. We know automatically that if we make a decision of higher power, our life that was operated around a decision of lower consciousness will change. It has to. It can't be otherwise. So if you decide, for example, I need to cut the cord with a certain relationship that's draining me, your life automatically, the tapestry of it, automatically has to change phenomenally because that life drain is not there anymore. And so it's terrifying. It's terrifying to finally decide, I can't empower that anymore. As we work with the meditations, the purpose is to initiate a daily practice inside of you. So that when you recognize, I need to cut this cord, how do I do it? How do I do it? That you do it step by step in a way that you work into your interior and get to the point where that withdrawal is done without anger and without rage and without even that sense of, I need to do it, therefore I've got to do it. But rather this incredible gentle way of saying, my work with that person is done. I know why I was in his life or her life, at least so far as I can know. But the truth is I'll never know, so the best thing I can do is remove myself from the need to know why. Now that's power. When people are talking to me about their illnesses and why they've become ill, or why they're so challenged in life and can't seem to get through repetitive patterns, these are power questions. Why can't I manage my power better? Why is it when I'm in a circumstance with a certain kind of person, I instantly feel that jealousy, I instantly feel that rage? Why can't I hold that center? Why can't I heal this illness? The next most prominent question I have, why isn't this illness healing? And what I recognized as I listened to people talk about what they do when they begin to enter the healing path, they'll say to me, Carolyn, I am doing everything I can, homeopathic remedies, acupuncture, aromatherapy, and they will list all of the numerous techniques that they are following, all of which are extremely valuable. But they're lacking one huge ingredient. They're lacking the ingredient that ignites it all. They don't have enough power in their system. These are energy tools for healing. They require energy. I want to put it in a financial portrait. Again, you're given $100 of energy a day. You're managing your past now. You're giving $5 to a memory of a relationship you had in grade school where someone said, you'll never be any good at sports. You're keeping that alive for some reason, and it's costing you $5 a day. You review your childhood and you think, I'm just so angry because I should have, could have, would have had this and my parents this. And that's costing you $25 a day. Because keeping things alive costs money, energetic money. And then you think about a relationship that you are very uncomfortable with, or a divorce you haven't gotten over, or a job that was very uncomfortable and you left and you have unresolved anguish over. And then you give $35, $40 to that. You're left with maybe $12 to $20 in your account every single day through which you need to empower your body, your mind, your spirit, your insight, your creativity, the entire life around you, running on $20 a day when it costs $100. So now you're running into deficit. What does this have to do with energetic healing? It has everything to do with energetic healing. Because energetic healing is expensive. It costs an enormous amount of money. If you look at aromatherapy or any one of these techniques, you need to have at least 60 units of your energy in your internal bank account to activate it. Otherwise, it's merely perfume. It's merely a sweet-smelling substance. The power you need is phenomenal. You need to get your energy into present time in order to take this wonderful little vial of sweet-smelling rose essence and convert it from perfume to power fragrance. It requires the electricity of your energetic system. It requires your power. You need to imprana it. And this is expensive. When I look at people who enter into healing, they say to me, I'm going to use these wonderful healing objects, crystals, etc. These are nothing but stones for them until they can imprana it. The crystal will remain sleeping as a stone because you can't access its electricity. Your body remains too dense. And I would have to refer you to the best of chemical medicine because energetic medicine lies low. If you were to say to me, how do I activate it? I would say to you, well, let's begin. Let's talk about forgiveness. Let's talk about your capacity to pull your energy back from places it shouldn't be and to invest them in places it should be. Faith, trust, love. The first order of business is to find out how strong your will is and where your will is. You have to take a look at how much control you want over your external life versus your internal life and whether or not you are willing to relinquish that control. That automatically brings the issue of, do you really trust this God you say you trust? Do you really trust that? The humorous part, the paradoxical part, is that we say we do. And what is so ironic is all of us realize we can't outrun whatever divine force this divine force is, but we try it continually by screaming we have faith. Again and again, we have to look at this divine irony, this divine paradox. So often I've noted with people who are doing visualizations that they start out of a crisis. And then they'll tell me it's not working. It's not working. What they fail to recognize, perhaps what we all fail to recognize, is that when the time comes for us to need a strong spirit, we need to recognize we haven't trained that spirit. We haven't trained that spirit. Up until now, the spirit within us, our willpower, has been more or less allowed to do whatever it wants to do. To go wander down the street and stop at a store and do whatever it wants. To wander into a health pattern and do whatever it wants. To produce excuses as to why we shouldn't be doing what we know we should be doing. I know one person, and I recently had a conversation with her. I was talking to her about the nature of forgiveness, because there isn't one human being I've ever met in my life, and there probably will never be, who does not struggle with the central command of the human experience, which is forgiveness. It is the central command. Love comes after that. It is rarely in my experience that love is the motivator. Love is the result and the treasure. But forgiveness has to be an act of will without making it cozy within us. It's got to be that kind of push at first. And once we get through that initial, I've actually really truly forgiven something. After that, it is the love, compassion energy that suddenly begins to kick up inside of us that allows us to do the next time easier. And the next time easier. And here I am in this conversation with this woman, and she maintains the position that when offended once, that person can't come near her again. So I, being the sort of subtle person I am, said, "So, like, are you a Christian?" I mean, I would have been content to do that if she were a Buddhist or anything. No religion stops me. And I said, "So, are you a Christian?" "Oh, yes, very devout, an actual churchgoer," which is fine. I honor that completely. And I said, "What is the central message of Jesus? What did he teach?" She looked at me because she knew what I was about to do, but nothing stops me when I have my antenna up. And I said, I could be wrong, but after 40 years in the church, I think it goes something like forgiveness. Is that familiar to you?" And her jaws got clenched. And I said, "Well, I want you to explain something to me, and I'll leave you alone. But I want you to explain why, if you believe so deeply in a religion, why you really don't practice it. Why, for you, do you equate the practice with merely the act of walking into a church, but you really don't practice it? You review it, but you don't practice it." And she couldn't respond because I got her between a rock and a hard spot. I know that I live between that rock and a hard spot myself. So I know what that feels like. I just like to know I have company there. But you see, this is where that act of self-examination comes in. This is practice. Practice is self-examination. That's what we need to think about it in the meditations. We enter our day with conscious self-examination, where we review what lies ahead of me today. And do you leave a place for divine entry, X factors that you didn't see coming? Would you recognize them if they came in? How do we hold the position that no matter what happens to us, it's by divine design? So if you miss an airplane, instead of bashing the person at the counter, which I'm capable of doing, you can pull back and say, "I wasn't supposed to be on that airplane," and go treat yourself to a cappuccino. Why don't we live in that place? All right? When you review your day, I want you to weave in these beautiful places of miracle entry so that you lose the illusion that you're in charge of anything. The only thing we're in charge of is to direct our will into what we recognize as illusion and to call your will back from that illusion. You're in a controversy and you say, this is illusion. I'm not buying into this. This situation's an illusion. And you call your will back and you say, I'm not investing you into that illusion. It's going to cost too much. I'm going to have to maintain you. You're a $5 a day illusion. Think of it that way. Think of it in those terms. You're a $5 a day illusion. You're a $10. You're a $30. Imagine doing business with someone and making up your mind that says, I'm not going to do business with you because you're a $70 a day illusion. And that's just going to cost too much. And I've got better things to do. So you want to look at your power in that way. Power and spirit, power and soul, these are all the same words. It becomes very humorous when you begin to think of it this way and you start to look at life through that lens of illusion. Every single great teacher produces the presentation to hold within yourself that the way of discipline and the purpose is to get to the point where you actually recognize, not mentally, that things, life, the physical world is an illusion, but that we actually manage to live there. That we actually manage to live according to that. Imagine now that you were to do a meditative practice that says, I'm about to enter illusion today. I'm about to enter illusion. So that you enter illusion consciously and you leave it consciously to prepare for the night. To me, this is a practice that helps us all because we have to become mindful of exactly where we live in this world. I want to discuss now the questions I'm asked most because that will be of the greatest assistance to you. First, how do I forgive? The first thing you want to admit to yourself is you're never going to want to. Otherwise, you wouldn't need to ask the question. Nobody ever wants to forgive. You may want to forgive, but you don't really want to forgive. There's a huge difference. I think we need to recognize, and this is where sweet truth comes in, is that why is it that God's made it so difficult for all of us? What's in it for us that it's so difficult? Because any time something is really difficult, the jewel in the box is worth having. So we can sit back and philosophize, why is forgiveness so difficult? This takes the person you're supposed to forgive out of the picture entirely. Which is step one. Get them out of the picture. And begin to go into the whole subject of, why is this so difficult? There's something more going on here than just forgiveness. I'm not that blind. So you begin to think, maybe it has to do with whether or not I can trust that something greater is going on behind this circumstance than I am capable of witnessing. That there was a reason why this situation happened, and I'll never be able to know that reason, perhaps. But what I'm asked to do is, can I trust that there is a reason? In which case, I will pull back my resentment that it happened. Always remember that there are just as many people taking workshops to get over having known you as you are getting over having known them. So let us keep things in proportion, right? You're not the only people taking notes on relationships you've had. So that it really helps you a great deal if you look at it and say, all right, this is a relationship dynamic. It's very, very hard when the violation has been tremendous. I always recognize that there are certain crises in life that are phenomenally difficult to let go of. Phenomenally difficult. How do you tell someone who's been through something like a Holocaust, just let go, forgive and let go? How do you tell someone who's lost a child, well, get on with your life, forgive and let go, move forward? These are questions that we need to address too. Where do you get the power to do that? Where do you get the inner strength to do something like that, to move forward? Because at some point in each of our lives, we're going to have an experience that's that size. We're all going to get walloped. with something that size. Nobody gets through without it. The reality is it better to say don't forgive? Is it better to say, well, if I were you, I'd stay bitter for at least the next two lifetimes because that's the size of crime this is in your life? Do you serve anyone or do we serve ourselves by saying to ourselves, I think I'm going to destroy the rest of my life because of this? What we do recognize is this is the worst thing I'll ever experience. So what do I do now? You plot your strategy. The forgiveness strategy has to include the following. One, you need a prayer ritual. You need a prayer practice, a prayer routine, because you are going to go in and out of that state of wanting to forgive and wanting not to. Why? Because the concept, idea, and desire to forgive is going to be processed by your mind one day and your heart the next. Your mind one day and your heart the next. When it gets to your mind, the theory of it feels wonderful. When it drops to your heart, you go on a destruction path, a seek and destroy, take no prisoners approach. And then it goes back to your mind and you rationalize and you do it again. In between the mind and the heart is the fifth chakra, the choice part. And this is where you've got to initiate power. In every moment and in every day, you have to make a choice that follows either the mind or the heart. And you start out small. And you say, no, I've got to follow the heart path. One of the best ways is this. Don't look backwards. Don't talk about the event. You want to talk about it? Go to a therapist. Tell yourself, I'm going to talk about this 5 or 6 times. That's it. That's all I want. And then we're going to talk about my present life and how I can see value and creativity and love in my present life. But my task is not to go backwards. I must become stronger than my history. The second thing is, learn not to speak woundology. When someone comes up to you and discusses the past, or when you have an opportunity to be in a discussion and you feel that temptation to come up and say, oh, well, you know what this person did, or you know what I'm going through, you know about my childhood, catch yourself. Catch yourself and say, do you want to repeat this again? Where would it serve you to repeat this? Ask yourself that question. Where would I be served in my growth if I repeat telling this story? How would it serve me? 3, as you answer that question, ask yourself, what am I looking for here? Sympathy? Power? Why would I repeat this story? Go into your own analysis. Go into your own relationship to power in that moment. And then make the choice. I'm not going to tell this story. It doesn't serve me. It doesn't serve me because what I'm really looking for is power. I want them to attend to me. I want this. And you can tell yourself, this really isn't healing. This is woundology. Healing is what I do with a therapist when I walk in her door and I say, I'm dealing with a crisis. I was molested when I was a child. I'm just ready to deal with that. I've decided it's going to take me 6 months and you are going to help me in a 6-month period of time. We're going to go back. We're going to go into my past. We're going to process it. At the end of 6 months, you and I, we're done. That's how you do it. You give yourself a time limit because you can give yourself a time limit. And that's all there's to it. And you get yourself back to present time. Another suggestion in the task of forgiveness is to put the issue on the side. It'll meet you down the road. Focus in on the journey of becoming stronger because it happened, not on trying to figure out why it happened. Get your eyes off that intention and tell yourself, I'll figure that out later. It'll come later. Right now, I've got to become strong enough to not need to know why it happened. That's my task. Not to find out why, but to not need to know why. Get your intention on the right track and on the right question. That's what's crucial. That's the point you want to make. These are the dynamics you want to keep your attention on. And this helps forgiveness. And all the while, the journey between the mind and the heart, the mind and the heart. And when your heart starts rationalizing and giving you wonderful reasons why you should forgive, hold on to those. And when it gets to the heart, rush your mind there immediately. Rush it there as fast as you can. And say to the heart, I've had enough of your mourning and your weeping. I'll allow you 3 hours of this a week. But that's enough, because it no longer serves the healing. I heard you. I walked with you. I wept with you. It no longer serves our healing to leave you in this situation. I'm now doing you a disservice to leave you here. It no longer is serving our life, and I have to get you out of there. Make it a daily discipline, because very few among us can look at a circumstance and say, that's it, it's forgiven. Some of us can. I recently heard one of my dearest friends talk about a gentleman she met very briefly on an airplane ride. The whole airplane ride was one of those horrible situations in which the original flight was canceled and he was scheduled to go first class, but when they brought in the new plane, it didn't have as many seats, and he was then sent to the back of the bus, so to speak. He only had one leg. And so for him, this was a very difficult thing. He had to walk on crutches, and he had a prosthesis, and it was very, very hard. And she sat next to him, and he had just lost his leg recently because of a car accident. And he'd been in therapy, et cetera, et cetera. And what he said to her was, well, one morning I woke up in the hospital and I looked down and I realized, well, look what's gone. And he said, well, that's that. I got to get on with my life and figure out how to walk a different way. And he said, and I noticed people feel sorry for me. And he said, I let them. He said, but it won't do me any good. And he said, so I don't let it into my system. This man was a fountain of power and of strength. I don't even know him, and I've been touched by his story. The man that hit him was drunk, apparently. He could be very angry. He could hate that person for the rest of his life, and he knows that. And he said, I could. And he said, but what good would that do me? He says, it's going to make my leg come back. He said, why should I live my life living under the blanket of hatred? I would never walk again if I do that. And he said, now I have to think, well, all right, now I'm going to learn to live my life this way, and my life goes on, and maybe there's a reason for this. And he lives in this consciousness. And here she said that while the rest of the plane was in a tizzy because it was late and they had to wait 3 hours for this next flight, he was the only one left standing, quote unquote, in a center of peace. I find the whole story to be absolutely magical. So these are the suggestions, and the part of that question that says, how do you know when you've forgiven? How do you know? You know because when you go near it, you don't feel a fire. It doesn't stick. It doesn't burn. You don't feel that rage flow through, and it's not conditional. You say, well, you know, I've gotten over this part, but then there's this. I mean, when you really have forgiven something, it just doesn't have any sting to it. As a reference point, I'm going to ask you as you listen to this to think about something that happened to you when you're a kid that you now laugh about, when you weren't invited to a pool party, or you think that's one of my memories, right? But I wasn't. I wasn't invited to a pool party. And when I was a child, this really, I hated those people as a result. I just really was mean, and I just resented them, and I was in that kind of state of mind. Now I think it's hilarious, because when I think about the way I behaved and the fact that I stole the ball that you play with in the pool to get even and all this kind of nonsense. But now when I look back, it's hilarious to me. That's how you know when you've forgiven, that you can recall a memory. You may not be able to turn it into a hilarious one, but you can talk about it from that place that says, this happened, and I learned a lot, and you don't feel yourself being drawn back into that memory where you start to exclude things. I know I forgave except for this part of it, and if I only knew this, I really could let it go. And you haven't forgiven at all. It brings you into that heart of that part of you that says, but I want a reason why they hurt me. I want that. And if I don't have that, I'm not letting this go. What you're really facing is your faith more in the rational controlling mind within you than in the, quote, irrational divine mind around you. Which one do you want? I want to bring you more deeply into this and say, why are we afraid of the, quote, irrational divine mind? If we are looking toward reaching divine intimacy, why are we so afraid of divine intimacy? We've got to pursue that question. It's because here we know again and again, deep in your unconscious, you know that if you get that close to divine intimacy, you really relinquish the control of what happens in your life. You relinquish the illusion of control. And that also means you relinquish the speed at which events unfold in your life. You let go of speed. And the speed factor is one of the most phenomenally illusionary dynamics we've created in our lives. I'm going to explain that because it needs depth. Speed is the consequence of what we hold on to or what we let go of. There's a speed factor contained in every single memory and in every single thought. Everything has an element of speed. Now, if you're holding on to a great deal of your history, actually, the real reason, the deeply true real reason, if we rifle through one more of your diaries and one more of your pieces of paperwork, is that at the very, very bottom is your need to control the speed at which events unfold in your life. That's the real reason. On top of that is the layer of, which is why I can't forgive this event. Because if I do forgive this event, the speed increases in my life. Things will move faster. Dynamics will move faster. It's not forgiveness that's so difficult. It's the speed of change that it will create that we can't manage. Because that's where faith comes in. Now let's combine this with this factor. When we're capable of an act of forgiveness, what does that change within us? It changes the manner in which we see the whole presentation of God and the whole universe. We change the whole thing. We've just disintegrated one of the central illusions of life, which is that you hurt me personally. And we've replaced it with the perception that maybe it was one of those things that had to be. Maybe there's something in here I had to learn about myself. Then, the next thing you know, you start feeling good about yourself, not in an egocentric way, but rather in this sense of strength. I really have a lot of strength. I mean, there's some part of me that has a strength reserve I didn't know I had. I don't even know where it came from. All I know is, in that instance, when I finally let go of something, nothing else made me feel that type of better. I felt good, but not this type. I had an experience in my own life once. The only time I've ever had to forgive anybody. What a lark. This is my first genuine act of forgiveness that goes on record in my own being. This was a dynamic with a person that was very, very stressful. They all are. And it got to be very, very nasty. They all do. Let's face it. We're not asked to forgive Santa Claus. Right? This is just a very difficult challenge. I began to feel myself getting more and more distant from this person, not in the ice-cold emotional way, like, I just am not going to talk to you again, but rather in an archetypal way. I began to see the circumstance and not the person. I began to recognize that this person really was a player in a drama, and that if it wasn't him, it would have been anybody else that could wear his shoes, that it was irrelevant that it was him. And when that became very obvious to me, I started to look at why I was in it. What was going on in me? And I took it into a journey of my own fears. Fear of what? Again, central fear of change. I could have said anything else. Fear of loss of control. But what does that mean? What are you losing control of? You're losing control of the illusions you believe keep change slow. At a slow-moving pace in your life. Always, always, always it comes back to that. So one evening he came into my house and we had an exchange, and as usual the dynamic was he ended up apologizing for an explosion, and I don't mean to present this in the way that said, poor me, I never did anything wrong about this. But nevertheless, the parts we played was that I was the victim, he was the aggressor, so the apology had to come from his side of the fence. This time when he came in, I was armed with a perception I'd never experienced before. I never experienced it before. I was actually deeply armed with the perception that I did not care how change came at all, from which direction, no matter which way it would take me, I had my bags packed and I was ready to go no matter which way the winds blew me. And I felt such a level of empowerment. It was a state of ecstasy. It was an actual state of ecstasy. And so when he stood opposite me, I didn't even draw a sword. When he said, well, let's go back to working together. And I knew in my center that this was over, that it was not meant to be, that whatever part of our relationship had come to pass was over. And when I said to him, no, it's over. It wasn't in a rage. My jaws weren't clenched like they can be. But rather, I was totally focused on the state I was focused on. I couldn't get my eyes off myself, never mind him. I couldn't believe that I could feel that way. And then I realized, there's nothing to forgive. I really know what it's like to be able to say to somebody, there's nothing to forgive. I really know in this instant what it's like to be able to say, I don't care what change comes next. I had such ridiculous trust. And I had that trust because that ecstasy felt so good. And I thought, this doesn't come from me. This is not my manufacturing. I can't do this. Because if I could, I'd do it all the time. I'd bottle it. But I mean, it was a phenomenal experience. And after that, exactly what I'm telling you happened. Change accelerated. Because once you learn that lesson, you get five more. Five more. Which means you have five more circumstances, five more challenges, five more challenges in people that have to find a way to enter your life. Now let's think about that. Means that when you have a new circumstance, what you're really doing is you're rearranging your house, i.e. the whole of your life, to provide for the entry of people that hadn't been allowed entry before because you didn't have room for them. Think of yourselves as maintaining your own planet and that it has an orbit and that you have to maintain a certain, quote, population on that planet depending upon your internal resources. And that when you have completed a role with a person who has demanded a great deal of your resources, you've completed it in such a way that now you have your power back. But not only do you have one unit of power back, because you've learned so much from that situation, you have 30,000 units of power inside of you that you never had before. What do you do with that power? All of us said, now think this through so clearly because it's so rich. There are so many truths in this universe that we know about. All is one, for example. We know that. All of you would pass that exam in here. But can you activate that truth is the question. Can you actually have enough energetic units in you to take that truth from a knowledgeable sixth chakra mental level and afford its electricity, turn on its juice so that it circulates through your biology, so that it circulates through the entire energetic ecology of your planet that you live on? Can you do that? For most people, that truth is a book on a shelf. They go into a coffee shop and they take the book down and they read about All is One and they know it's true, but they can't access the electricity. They can't get high off of it. They just know it's true. It's a goal they want to reach. Now let's go back to this example or experience. You've forgiven somebody. You really have done it. You are now snorting forgiveness juice. Right? And you have extra fuel like you've never known it before. Now, if I were your angel, I would put in front of you a new perception that you have previously only known, but now you can afford it. Now you can afford it. And when I say afford it, what does that mean? It means once you can afford a perception, you are giving it permission to reorganize your life. Let me say that again. Once you can afford a perception, you are giving it permission to come in and reorganize the whole of your life. Put yourself on your planet again. Visualize the orbit. The orbit is the field you keep everything out of until you're ready for its entry into your planet. And you look at it and you can see that thought orbiting, but it can't come into the planet. Now it comes into the planet and restructures. And it says, so now you know all is one. So now you have the electricity of me. Watch what I do. And it has to, by virtue of that electricity, come in and reorient every one of your perceptions so that that truth is the core truth that is operating within your experience with that person. What does that mean? It means that you are reproducing that truth. What does that mean? It means that you're taking that perception and you're converting it into physical matter on your planet. Now, before, it was a rich, wonderful truth that existed in the orbit, but you couldn't afford its electricity. One way that I express this to people and explain it is that in the benevolence of the universe, they educate us with truths before we can afford the electricity to plug into those truths. Our role is once we see a truth on the horizon and we say, I want to learn that truth, I want that one, then we're given the challenges in our lives that get us to the point where we can manage the electricity that goes along with having that truth in our system. I've watched us again and again sabotage the road to consciousness. We all do it. We all say, I want to become a fully conscious person. And then when I say to my students, well, what does that mean? They always give me very etheric answers that don't mean anything. That means I'll be in full harmony. With what? With myself. What does that mean? Peace. What does that mean? Tranquility. You already said that. All-knowing. All-knowing what? All-knowing everything. What does that mean? Awareness. Awareness of what? And this is the way the question goes. I pondered this for a long time, and what I realized is if you answer a question with meat on the bones, meaning I want awareness. I want awareness of myself. I want awareness of why I have the shadow I do. Not in a punitive sense. The shadow only means that part of me I don't see. I want to know why when I look at something it scares me. I want to know why I don't have faith in God under these circumstances, but only under these. I want to know why I always pray to get my own way, because if I really studied my prayers, that's what they are. I want my own way. I want to know why I really don't trust anything in this universe. I want to know why I'm not a forgiving person. I want to know why the only quality and level of love I reach is self-serving. There, those are the questions I want answered, God. Give it to me. Every one of us knows that if we said, those, give me those, I want those because I need those questions. I need to know those questions in order to become this thing called conscious. So give it to me. Because every one of you has to know that you can say, I want to become conscious, and it is not a package you receive on your front door. It is a path work. It is a discipline, repeat discipline. We don't use that word because it's uncomfortable. And what does it mean? It means that your life has to then contain the challenges that will bring to the surface the answers to the questions you are asking. If we pray, help me to be forgiven, and to be forgiving, help me to be forgiving, then you're going to get at least 300 people you can't forgive. How else will you learn? You think a textbook will do it? This is hardcore work in the field. This is how we learn. We don't have physical bodies if we did not need physical experiences. So now with every one of those learnings, think of this. We get a new wire in our system. We're getting rewired. We're getting reprogrammed. For what? So that we can take a truth, the truth that we saw on our horizon that motivated this journey in the first place, that all is one, we can take that truth and afford its new electrical voltage. And if you suddenly have 3,000 inspirations that naturally stem from a perception that great, you're going to have to do a whole new inspired life, aren't you? And what if that whole new inspired life says, I now know in this divine mystical revelation that all is one. And you're talking to someone who hasn't reached that electricity point. And they say, yeah, well, all is one. Yeah, right. What do you want for lunch? And you say, you don't understand. I know it. It's in my blood now. It's in my body. It's in my mind. It's in my soul. And therefore, I have to incarnate a life that allows that teaching and truth to come into me. What does that mean? It may mean you leave everything behind that you know that could not live with the electricity of that voltage because you're wired differently. You can walk into your home again. I mean it as basic as this. You can walk into your home. You can walk into an office. You can walk into a relationship. And it no longer serves the all-is-one truth that you're now plugged into. It served you learning it, but it doesn't serve you now that you've learned it. It doesn't serve you in the creation of what will come next from it. You are on the other side of that truth. You've gone from learning it to having learned it. You've gone to the level of needing to be someone who does something in the physical world with it, from it doing something in you to you doing something with it. You are now a totally transformed being. And the world that was your classroom is no longer essential. It's a very frightening part of your life. You enter in here, that dark space, the dark night. This is a form of the dark night of the soul. In you go. I'm telling you, you were born knowing that with every truth you electrify, you enter a type of dark night. Because with the ecstasy comes the agony. These two principles stand together. They always have and they always will. This is one of the reasons I see again and again and again that people sabotage their spiritual path, because we are frightened of this. We are frightened of this thing called God, because this energy called God will change, does change our physical life. That is the way it is. It will always be that. I've come to realize that when we look at all of the divine truths, and if I said to every one of you, list every single thing you know to be true, every single thing, none of your pages would be longer than one. None of them. And one of the reasons why the divine prevents us from electrically accessing those truths as easily as we can write them down is because they would blow our circuits. And I mean that literally, and I mean it physically. I mean the voltage of those truths is so powerful that when it comes into your body, your neurological system has to adjust. Your physical system has to adjust. There is not one part of you that isn't rerouted or readjusted to the power of a new truth. It is a new electrical circuit. It comes in and it can start you feeling this absolute compulsive need for a new diet. You've got to have it. You can feel this need for a cleansing, or it can take over and cleanse you. In comes an illness. In comes a force stronger than you'd ever seen before, and you find yourself vomiting. You find yourself absolutely experiencing the breakdown of your body, sometimes bringing you to death's door, because you experience the metaphor of the phoenix rising from the ashes. This truth crumbles you. It totally turns you into an ash, and then you rise from those ashes. You're elevated on the voltage of that perception. And what dies underneath it is everything that your life lived while you didn't know that truth, and now you do. You cannot have the same life. And I've watched it again and again and again, and here I've watched when people are ill and they say, how come I'm not healing? I know that if I believe, I know this, I know that, but I know they haven't got the electricity to touch that truth. So it hangs around their orbit, but it can't get to their planet. They can't access it. Therefore, their biology, their planet, which is your body, which is the whole of your life, cannot truly be electrically converted. You can't actually take the voltage inherent in that perception and have it maneuver your cell tissue, because you're not strong enough to handle it. You have not prepared to maintain that level of power in your system. Again, we return to the core teaching, which is power. Power is your spirit. If we don't learn how to manage that power, it will just blow us into any which direction, because we don't have the strength to hold ourselves steady. We don't have it. And so every loose attitude that flies through the air rips into our pocket and takes 50 cents out. And suddenly we're supporting every loose thought in the atmosphere, because we have not the power to maintain our own bank account. Someone can come up to you and say, I think you've failed in this project. I think you've done a miserable job. And you've just lost $90. You've just invested $90, and now you won't get it back until you figure out some way to get that person's approval. Imagine if you had that quality of strength that said, I am not giving you 1 cent for that opinion, and it's not because I resent you. If you do it out of resentment, you've just slipped it out the back door. You do it out of the perception that says, no, my money's actually invested in the fact that I was supposed to do this, and I'm not going to get attached to the outcome, and somehow, in some way, it's going to serve someone. So I understand some people will express that opinion or the others, but even your opinion's an illusion, and that's the sweetest truth of all. Even your opinion of me is an illusion. So I'm not financing illusions. I know better than that. You have to do this in an empowered way. And here comes another level of empowerment. We can move into the idea of what is guidance? Where do we get our direction? Where does it come from? How do we know when we're making up something and when we're not? How do we know what a right or a wrong decision is? How do you know when your life is being directed to go one way or another? You need to know that. To know when you're being told to move in a certain direction or to stop something. Here again is the challenge of trust, a pattern I've learned under the heading of divine paradox is the more trust you have, the more absurd things will be required of you. It's the way it goes. The more trust you have, the more preposterous actions the gods will ask of you. And there's a reason for this, so far as I am able to understand reason. And that's that if I were to ask you to do something, and I asked you because you had an expertise in it, there's a real good chance we were going to have a challenge on our hands because it would be your expertise versus mine, or your will versus mine. There's also a sense that we could work together beautifully, but there's also this other risk. Whereas, if I asked one of you who knows nothing about it, your dependency on my guidance would be 100%. And the guidance would flow through to you because you are totally vulnerably in my hands. Now that is a supreme act of trust on your part, that I will come through and give you everything you need to know. That is why the gods probably draft people that the more evolved you get, the more absurd your task becomes in terms of your personality, more profound in terms of your soul. Because you're reversing the priority so that the power of your soul takes over the power of your personality. In the process of self-examination, in the process of the practice, it is crucial every day to ask what motivates you. What motivates me? What am I motivated by? Am I motivated by my fear or am I motivated by trust? What's my agenda? Is my agenda trust or is it fear? If my agenda is fear, then I'm choosing out of a lack of trust for the divine. In which case, what do you think you're going to discover after you make that choice? You're going to confront your fear because what you have really chosen is let me see my fear as to why I can't follow you. And you're going to meet it right behind that door. Whereas, if you say, I can't afford to be motivated by fear, therefore, if I'm asked to open a door I've never looked at before, I simply have got to go through it. I simply have to do it. Then you're going to open that door and find one preposterous synchronistic assistance after another. One absurd miracle after another. I don't even know why we use that word. I mean, it's simply the way it is. It's simply the language of trust. It is not a great big, huge, big deal that requires 4,000 candles and 6 hours on your knees. It simply is that which life should be, which is one divine miracle after another. I think that if we really could see life the way it is, that we would observe that you don't even walk across the street without angelic guidance. That you actually really don't sneeze without an angel saying, now, do it. I think we can laugh at these small things, but the smaller and more ridiculous examples that we actually can decide are probably divinely motivated because we are so accustomed to thinking that guidance should be huge, like the breaking of the Red Sea, or as soon as I see the china fall out of the cabinet, I know I should move. But the fact is, it's very subtle. Most guidance is homeopathic. It's very, very subtle. Angels speak homeopathy fluently. All right? And they don't necessarily pressure us that way. They move in those side of wing flitters that say, there's something going on here. There's something going on here. And I think every now and again they call in the major leagues like a Michael or a Gabriel with a horn saying, will you please listen? And so where do we get guidance? How do you know? You can assume the following, because it's truth with a TH, not true. It's true we're here on Tuesday. But it's not truth because there's another part of the world where it's not Tuesday. So it's just true for us. But truth is this, that guidance exists at all times. There isn't one moment where there isn't guidance. Not one moment. Back to the issue of power. The core question is, are you empowered enough to hear the guidance? So this is where self-examination, the discipline, comes in, which is, why do you fear guidance? Why do you fear it? You don't have to light 30,000 candles for guidance. Guidance is non-stop. The question is, reverse it. Why do I fear the guidance I'm getting? That's what you want to examine. Not where is the guidance, but why do I fear it? You can assume it's present. It's all coming in. The challenge is for people to admit that they will not accept guidance as guidance until it comes in the following package. One, it has to guarantee the safe journey across the bridge to the next place in your life. Two, it has to promise financial success or financial safety. Three, it has to promise financial success and financial safety. I repeat it twice, because all of you and all of us want God to play the stock market on our behalf. The next thing, we want an absolute guarantee of romantic connection and emotional safety. This is the guidance we're looking for. The next thing we want God to be is a promise stuffologist, that we can take all of our stuff with us to the other side of this guidance and not have to sell anything at a divine garage sale in the meantime. This is what we think guidance should be. Admit it. And you need to admit that to yourselves. This is part of self-analysis, spiritually speaking. This is part of the discipline. So that instead of going into the discipline with, I wonder why, you go into the discipline with, I know exactly why. I'm afraid to hear from you, and now I need to know why. That's what I want. I don't want guidance on what I should do next. I know what I should do next, which is why I don't want to know that. Reverse it. This is what's true. I know what I should do next. I don't want to hear about that. I want to hear why you're not promising me the safe things I want. That's what I want to know. So will you promise me? That's what I want to hear. And I want it in written contract, and I want you to promise that you won't upset me and that I won't ever have another thing to forgive and I won't be hurt. And you pray, and we pray like children. And we expect a paternal and maternal God, and that's not the way it is. The real guidance is to say, I'm afraid of guidance. So I want guidance as to why I'm afraid of guidance. This is nonsense, but this is truth. And here again is that level of power. I must have the power to listen to the guidance. I've got to be empowered to listen to guidance. Where do you go with that? You go into the study and the discipline of looking at your attachments, of looking at your fears. I'm terrified. I am terrified that you're going to ask me to do something that makes me vulnerable in this world, that exposes me. I'm terrified that you're going to ask me to do something that requires my physical body become ill to serve you. I am terrified that you're going to ask me to give up everything I own in order to serve you. I'm terrified. So I will come closer to you if you promise me that the exchange will be fair. But I am terrified to really relinquish my will to you, because I have no guarantee, no promise from you that the journey will be safe. All I know is it hasn't been for most people who've done this. So how do I handle this? Most of us put ourselves in a faith crisis deliberately. Oh my, I'm in a faith crisis. I have no idea what to do next. But you do know. It's as simple as that. When they say the answer's within us, it sounds like such a vague, amorphic response. Where do I look? What do? Look under my shirt? Where is this? But it is within us. It's as simple as that. It's within recognizing, I don't want the answers to the prayers I'm saying. I don't want them. I don't want the guidance to the guidance I'm asking for. My counsel to you, again and again, is turn it upside down. Reverse what you're praying for. Reverse it. Reverse it, reverse it. Learn the practice of reverse. Turn it upside down. When you say, give me guidance on X, Y, or Z, turn it upside down and say, what would be the most frightening guidance I could hear on X, Y, Z? If you say to yourself, I'm not receiving any guidance in my life, I don't know what to do next, reverse it. Show me what would scare me the most that you're probably asking me. Pray in reverse. Reverse it. Go in through your back door instead of your front. And you'll get to know yourself much better, much better, much better. I am convinced that the reversal practice is the way you get into your heart without your mind seeing it. You come in through your back door and you begin to see yourself in such a way because you've never studied yourself in reverse. You've never done that. You've never upside-downed your questions. Your defense mechanisms mentally aren't prepared for the reverse. And when you say it in a prayer and you say in your discipline, I want to know why I'm afraid of you, not show me the way to come closer, you're going to get a whole different quality of answer, aren't you? You've just asked for a whole new set of experiences to teach you an insight that you weren't prepared to look at before because you never admitted to yourself. I'm afraid of this very thing I claim I want, which is consciousness. I asked a group of students, I've done this several times now because I get such a kick out of it, and I've said, how many of you are serious about this practice to become conscious? And all of their hands go up, except a few who know what's coming. And by the way, on that note, I will add that one of the reasons why you don't answer these questions is because, again, deep in your system, you know that if you do, what you've just given the gods permission for is to change your life according to your answers. So back to this. And I said to this one group, so what are you willing to relinquish in your life in order to get to this goal you claim you want, which is consciousness? And there was a hush over the room for a moment because they know here comes trouble. Because inherently it kicked in. Uh-oh, if I answer this, uh-oh. Well, prior to that moment, they'd never even thought about that. They'd never even thought about the fact that this goal of consciousness was actually something they were more afraid of than something they really wanted. It sounds wonderful on paper. Oh, how good that sounds. Most of us are simply conscious librarians. We keep a whole bookshelf of conscious books in our house and et cetera, et cetera. And it's so much fun, but we don't reverse them. We don't say, okay, what is it in this book that I would be afraid to learn? That's how you read a book. What is it in there that I am afraid to learn? What would cause me to consciously grow and develop that I am now prepared to block? Reverse everything. Turn it upside down. That's how you get into it. Go through the back door again and again. So I said to this group of people, would you be willing to give up everything or anything? And now you find how much you really don't want to be conscious. You really don't want it. It sounds good on paper, and what you want it is in small doses. You want to be conscious of this mystery, back to forgiveness. Why did that person hurt me? And if I said to you, okay, let me give you the whole portrait of your life, and here you have little conscious chips like a checkerboard. And you put your conscious chips over the place where you want to be conscious. Now you're looking at how you pray. You put one unit of prayer over your childhood. I want to be conscious of that incident. And another one over this relationship. And another over this. And that's what you want consciousness about, isn't it? At the end of the day, that's exactly it. You really don't want it in the big picture. You want it in tiny tidbits. And I assure you, you'll want it over your past before you want it over your present time. So if you really were to pull out all stops and say, go for it, God, take whatever you need, I think that's a really rough prayer, if you want to know the truth. This one woman answered this. I love this answer. She says, I really want to be conscious, but here's the thing. I don't want to give up my art classes. I don't want to go back to work. My husband does that for me, and, you know, it's not the best marriage, but it works financially. And, you know what? I could give up my Tuesday and Thursday mornings. Now, you know, it sounds like I'm making this up. Do you want to know something? I'm not. And I can make up things. This isn't one of those. And I bring it up because of the absolute absurd and naivete with which this woman answered that question. She didn't even realize what she was exposing in that moment. And from that point of view, I give that innocent child in her a great deal of applause because, Lord knows, she was probably speaking for all of us, only we knew better than to admit it. But that was phenomenal to me. And, you know, for me, sometimes it takes that level of absurd experience for me to recognize as a teacher that that's really how we are underneath the surface. So we talk about the truth of power and discipline. And what we're really talking about is, do we have the power to enter into the part of ourselves we really don't want to know about? The part of ourselves that prays opposite our conscious prayers. We have a whole part of ourselves that says those other prayers, that puts the stops on it, that says, you know, God, I want consciousness, and then the other part says, but not too fast, and I don't want it to cost me anything. And we don't realize, and this is something that's very curious to me, why we associate becoming conscious with so much pain. Why do we do that? Why do we associate becoming conscious with loss instead of gain? Why do we do that? I've never met someone who doesn't make that assumption. And even if they say, oh, I don't, it's their ego talking to me. It's the defensive ego part of the persona. I dismiss it to say, see how frightened you really are. I've never met anybody who doesn't pray with this sense of trembling in them before the God in front of them saying, I trust you, but I really don't. If we really held this sense of trust, and this is for the process of self-examination, this is why we all need meditations and the practice to go in and say, do I really trust this essence that I'm praying to? Do I really trust this force that I call God or the divine or Yahweh or whatever name you want to give this source? And if not, could you say, show me why I don't trust you? Put me into circumstances where I have to trust you. Wouldn't that be an extraordinary way to pray? But you see, even as I mention it, aren't we afraid of it? Aren't we afraid of it? Your fear cannot stop it. One student said to me, I just don't want to go down that road, Carolyn. I don't want to ask those questions. And I said, do you think by saying you don't, you can stop it? What do you think that is, the mantra of stop? That heaven is going to say, oh, okay, we'll respect your fears. Think about it. That's only going to send the fear tenfold, 10 times, into your back door saying, hi there. You can't stop that sort of thing. So what is consciousness if all we want is the reward of consciousness? We don't want the work of it. And we need to face that fact. We don't want the work, we want the reward. And we mourn about the lessons that we need to go through. Oh no, another person to forgive. Oh my. Oh God, another thing to change. Oh no, another cord to cut. But let's say we really were serious about this thing called consciousness. Let's just say. And we decided, I'm going to do this differently. I'm going to reverse my life. I'm going to go about backwards. I'm going to start praying like this. Give me someone to forgive because I have trouble with this one right here. Give me someone that's going to be hard to love so I can stretch my heart because I know that's coming. My heart's too small for this thing called the human experience. Give me something that will help me trust you more. Give me a nice dark room. I would appreciate a television, but if I can't have it. Think about this, all humor aside. I think in the archetypal symbolic way, we turn our lives upside down. It would be a complete reverse. Suddenly those things that we thought are so horrible would become beautiful. And suddenly the things that we see beautiful would become more beautiful. You can't lose by turning yourself upside down. Now let's look at it from a different point of view. When it comes to healing, or when it comes to maintaining your health in your body. So much of it revolves around how we maintain our spirits, how we maintain this power. How do we do it? We must have that daily practice so that we, one, recognize, what don't I have control over? What is stronger than myself? What seems to slip out of me in the blink of an eye that I can't seem to call back to myself? How come it has so much power over me? We've got to examine ourselves again and again and again. And then we have to be able to identify, what do I have power over? How come? Why is that so easy for me? What doesn't scare me? What do I have faith in? We have to have a daily review again and again and again. This is the discipline. This is the practice. This is the discipline. So that when we're in situations, and they will come every day and in every moment, where something interrupts us, instead of losing power to that, we can instantly empower the position, empower the perception that this has just happened. It's divine interference. This is divine interference. I'm going to let go of my need to have something work out the way I thought it should and recognize this is divine interference and take your hand off the steering wheel. Learn to put that shade up called divine interference. It absolutely reverses the stress in your body, and you learn the practice of, my job is to do the best I can in everything I do here, the best I can with my talent, the best I can with my heart, with my mind, with my spiritual practice, and I am not attached to the outcome. Part of a spiritual discipline practice is to have no attachments. That is difficult. How do I not have attachments? You asking me to do a beautiful piece of work and not put my name to it? No, put your name to it, but you're not attached to whether or not people like it. This is the question. Whether or not they like it or dislike it is irrelevant. Your job is to be the best at what and who you are. That's all you need to do. And that's everything, and that's the most difficult thing. Take your eyes off the target. Your target is yourself. You are to look at nothing else. You are to work only on your own emotions, your own psyche. One could say, but isn't that being selfish and narcissistic? Yes, but it's the right type of narcissism. If you keep your eyes focused on, how do I love? Am I a loving person? Or am I a selfishly loving person? Do I love and then sabotage other people's love so that I say, I see a friend of mine who's learning to love another person and I start saying horrible things about that other person so that I could keep that love all to myself? What type of love am I really capable of? You keep your eyes on yourself. And if you say to yourself, I really have a contaminated sort of love, then you work. And you say, God, let me clean that out. This is a conscious prayer. Not, God, bring that person back to me. But the conscious prayer, which is, remember why we're here. We're here not to get that person to love us, but to get ourselves to study love. Not just to love us, get that language out of your head, but to study love, to work with it. Part of which is the journey of loving the self, not yourself. Give it an impersonal word. It's an impersonal task. It is paradoxically, in the language of the gods, incredibly personal and totally impersonal simultaneously. That's the language of the heavens. So we learn self-love versus loving ourself. It is self-love. That is part of it. So we say to the gods, I am very jealous of another person's love going to another person. Then you say with the prayer, show me why. Show me that part of myself. What's going on here? Show me that. Think of the wisdom. You're actually asking and invoking with great clarity and experience to bring the truth to you that you need to see. Think of it. Think of it. Let's move on forward with power. I said to you earlier that becoming conscious has to do with speed. The more conscious we become, the faster change occurs in our lives. If you were capable of saying, I want the answer to this question, and give it to me in the 5-second variety, and you got it in 5 seconds, that means that the people in the setup are probably going to vanish. In one way or another, they may physically still be in your life, but the dynamic that existed between you to make that question surface is not going to be there. There's no reason for it. Right? Now, what have you said to yourself? I can't let that person go that fast. Let me let them go over 5 years instead of 5 seconds. I want it that way. You'll get it that way. But think about, now let's turn that into healing. Listen to this carefully. If you cannot handle change at 5 seconds, can you handle instant healing? Is this not the same thing? You can't have instantaneousness in one corner of your life and longevity of time in another. You can't do that. It is one and the same. So let's say you're on the healing path and your body has a very serious illness. And you say, I need to visualize. I need to have the power of visualization. You give your mind and your will the thought form that says, I want you to hold this thought. Dissolve the tumor. Bring me back full health. You've got to hold that thought. You have to imprana it. You've got to hold it steady enough so that you can bring enough electricity in it so that it can override the normal electricity of your body and enter into the cell mutation process. Dominate it. Use the quality of light in that visualization to blast out malignancy and take over the process of cell mutation. Do you hear how complex? Now, if your will is not even strong enough to be able to command your spirit to pull back from being angry at that person, do you honestly think you've got the will to change the shape of your body? Do you really think you do? Ask yourself that. Just ponder that for a moment. There's a real good chance you're not going to like the answer. So you can do your visualizations, but the truth is, it'll be more like a relaxation technique. It won't impact your biology the way you think. It'll impact it at the relaxation stage, and that's certainly wonderful, and it is a contribution to healing. But can it alter the cell tissue? Make it an absence of tissue so that you can sit up and say, I've dissolved that tumor. My spirit and energy was strong enough. What is dissolving? To reconvert it to an energetic pattern and release it. Dissolving means reconverting something into its energy. It is reversed homeopathy. You're reversing matter into energy. This is what you're doing. You need a lot of electricity to conduct that. That is not a simple thing to do. You need intense will, intense focus, and intense power. You need discipline. You need a meditation practice. You need this every day. This is not done casually. When I am with people who are in very difficult situations and they find themselves needing visualization or needing inner work and they haven't done much to date, and I watch people in workshops and they undergo a meditation. Someone says, let me lead you in a meditation. They can't hold their focus for 5 seconds. The slightest sound draws them out and I watch them snap, crackle, and pop at the sound of a fly around a light. You call that deep meditation? And you think the depth of that can actually alter your biology? Think this through seriously. You think the depth of that kind of meditation can actually penetrate into your soul and unearth that part of yourself that you need to look at and investigate? I don't think so. I think it can be tranquilizing for the instant. But what we all need to learn is, what is that capacity to become so still? Not only we can't hear a fly, we couldn't hear an airplane if we were in it. That we are absolutely capable of entering that internal place because we have the power to shut out the outside world and to begin that journey inside of ourselves that says, I'm going into my inner practice now. I want to know where my spirit is. I want to know why I can't command my spirit. Where is it? Where is my spirit? I need to know the prayers I'm afraid to say as well as the prayers I do say. I need to know the shadow side of my spirituality. I believe this is the route of that level of empowerment that brings us into ourselves, into that quiet place, you go through the back door. You go through the reverse door. And the meditations, the reverse door is contained in that. Because it's not enough to just say to you, I believe. It's not enough to just say to you, close your eyes and think positive thoughts. I need to show you why you're afraid of positive thoughts. And then give you positive thoughts. So in the meditations that follow, I'm going to be directing you through a morning meditation that takes you into the preparation of your day, up the scale of your chakras, into every one of these power zones, so you can organize them through the day, so you could check out what you're thinking in every one of these, because you are actually 7 thinking systems simultaneously routing your day. Then in the reverse, in the evening meditation, we're going to shut down. We're going to take a look at where you've invested your power that day. Who's got it? What you've gained? We're going to do your evening banking. And then you're going to prepare to enter your night. The preparation for leaving your body. You leave your body every night. You enter into that sweet place of angels and dreams. It's right to prepare for that. And it's right to come into your body with consciousness. In a morning discipline, in a morning meditation, think of it correctly. You're preparing for the day. You are entering your body. Not just your physical body, you're entering the body of your life. It's a rich entry. And then you're preparing to leave your body. The evening is the exit to the nocturnal plane. It's rich to enter there with, I need answers to these prayers. Help me here. I'm putting this out. Give me dreams. Speak to me. I want a language, and here again, I want to address this in terms of power. It takes a discipline to develop your own power language with your guide. It takes a discipline. You say to your guide, we need symbols between us. We need symbolic language here. Why would that be so difficult to get in the first place? Here again, I refer to the issue of time and speed. Most people like their guidance in the form of time, because their life changes more slowly. If you were absolutely able to speak angel fluently, and you ask for a prayer that says, should I quit my job? Yes. Would you be able to do that? Would you be able to do that? Could you act that fast? This is the question you have to ask yourself. Could you act that fast? If you could, yeah, you would get the answer that fast. That's what spiritual mastery is all about. That's why spiritual masters and great mystics could do that. They weren't afraid of the answers. That's the difference between us and them. They weren't afraid of the answers. They could handle any directive and any answer they got. That's the difference. And the journey is to become unafraid of that power and those answers. My intention is to take us into that part of ourselves. And every time you listen to these meditations, to make you that much more clear, that much more strong, that much more comfortable with the speed of change in your life.